Today, we're tackling something that's become, well, frighteningly common, particularly since the pandemic. We're talking about significant child absence from school, and it's an emotionally loaded topic, this one. We're going beyond simple ideas of truancy, looking at something much more nuanced, much more difficult. So our mission today is to really unpack the causes, the sheer scope, and frankly, the devastating impact of emotionally based school avoidance, EBSA for short. And then importantly, we're going to pivot. We'll explore a specific, quite forward-looking intervention, solution-focused hypnotherapy, or SFH. We're trying to understand what's behind this crisis of, well, capacity, and how maybe focusing on the future could unlock a solution.
Yeah, and just to set the scene with some data, the scale is it's massive. The Department for Education reported overall child absence figures for the 2023-24 academic year at 7.2%. Now, EBSA isn't the only reason for that spike, obviously, but it's definitely a major and growing part of it.
Yeah.
And pinning down exact numbers is tricky because EBSA is, you know, the term local authorities use operationally, but it's not a formal diagnosis like in the DSM-5.
Right. That's a really key point. The lack of a formal diagnosis, it leads us straight to the kind of aha moment of definition, doesn't it? If you really want to get EBSA, you have to understand the core difference between this and, say, simple defiance. EBSA is about the young person having these overwhelming negative feelings, anxiety, fear, just feeling totally swamped, physically stops them attending school. The absolute core truth here is that the child feels they can't go. Not that they won't go. It's a crisis rooted in their mental and emotional state, their capacity, not a desire to skip lessons.
Exactly. And because it's often hard to label precisely, you hear families, professionals too, using all sorts of terms almost interchangeably. Things like school refusal or school phobia. Sometimes EBSNA, emotionally based school non-attendance. But whatever label you use, the family is living with this profound distress. They're just asking, why can't my child walk through those school gates?
Okay, so let's explore that first section. What does it actually look like? You know, in practice, our sources mention it often starts quite subtly. Could be chronic lateness, maybe real difficulty separating from a parent in the morning, or maybe avoiding certain places in the school, certain people even.
Yeah, those are common starting points. But sometimes it's much more stark, much more obvious.
I remember one case study. A young person would do the whole morning routine perfectly, get dressed, eat breakfast, walk out the door, and then just freeze, literally freeze solid at the end of the driveway, completely unable to take those last few steps towards school.
And that's it. It's like a physical manifestation of this emotional paralysis.
So that internal battle, that emotional struggle, it makes the physical toll very real, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's not kids faking it to get out of school. That emotional distress actually triggers the central nervous system. Which leads to genuine physical symptoms, persistent nausea, sometimes debilitating fatigue, really bad headaches, stomach aches. And in the really tough moments, just the thought of school can bring on a full-blown panic attack.
Wow. That's intense.
It is. And this is what creates that kind of paradox we see. Unlike truancy, which, you know, sometimes gets linked to delinquency or acting out, children experiencing EBSA usually want to be in education. They often value it. They can seem perfectly fine, function normally at home or in other settings they feel safe in. But the school environment, it just shuts them down.
And yet they feel guilty about it.
Often, yes. Even when they're safe at home, there's this immense guilt, maybe isolation, because they know they're missing out.
Okay, that immediately shows just how complex this is. It's never just one single thing causing EBSA, is it?
Never. It's always multifactorial.
So let's dive into section two, get into those layers. What are the contributing causes the research points to? Maybe starting with the internal factors. What's going on inside the child?
Okay, internally.
Yeah.
Well, we see strong links to pre-existing mental health challenges. That could be generalized anxiety, social anxiety, separation anxiety, or it could be things like clinical depression, OCD, even PTSD in some cases. Sometimes it's more specific fears or real fear of failure, maybe fear of public speaking or being bullied.
That's quite a list already. It really underlines that EBSA isn't just one issue, but maybe a kind of cascade when these things meet the school environment.
It often is.
Yeah.
And something really vital to mention here is the intersection with neurodivergence. EBSA comes up frequently alongside conditions like autism or ADHD.
Yeah.
Because these conditions inherently bring challenges with social functioning, with emotional regulation, meaning the typical school environment, which demands constant social reading, often involves loud noises, crowds. It can just be incredibly overwhelming.
So when we talk about sensory overload, it's not just finding the classroom a bit noisy. It can be physically painful or exhausting for some kids.
Precisely. That constant sensory input, the required structure. It makes attendance a relentless battle for them.
Okay, so internal factors are huge, but the environment itself plays a massive role too.
Absolutely. The external pressures are significant. Things like active bullying or feeling socially excluded, left out. Even just the inherent stress of transitions can be a trigger. Worrying about moving up to secondary school, changing classes, new friendship dynamics.
And the sources also bring in the family dynamic, don't they, as another potential layer?
They do. Changes at home, things like parental conflict, maybe financial strain, or a bereavement in the family, they can create instability that ripples outwards. And interestingly, the research does flag certain parenting styles. Not to blame parents, but noting that perhaps overprotective approaches or high parental anxiety itself, or even inconsistent boundary setting. Sometimes these can inadvertently make a child's existing anxieties worse when it comes to school.
Right. It's all interconnected. So connecting this back to you, the listener, why does all this matter so much? What's the real impact?
Well, the impact is huge. EBSA leads to significant learning gaps, obviously, that can reduce future educational and even career opportunities. Mm-hmm. The isolation also chips away at social skills, and it creates this vicious cycle, often worsening mental health, lower self-esteem, rising anxiety.
And the strain on the family unit itself.
Immense. Huge parental stress, strain on relationships within the family, and just constant conflict over attendance, turning mornings into battlegrounds. The whole household lives under that pressure.
Okay, so we've really painted a picture of a complex, difficult problem with deep roots. How do practitioners, how does this SFH approach pivot away from that cycle of blame and failure? How do they actually start mapping a way forward?
Right. The fundamental principle of solution-focused hypnotherapy, SFH, is really key here. It deliberately doesn't dwell on the past trauma or endlessly analyze the negative experiences that led to the avoidance. Instead, it focuses squarely on a positive future, on the child's own goals for getting back to school, however small. The whole emphasis is on what works, not what's broken.
And it starts with understanding the brain.
Yes. That crucial first step is often psychoeducation, usually done in the first session, often with parents there too. It's about explaining the brain to the young person in a way they can grasp. The aim is to normalize their reaction.
I really like the metaphors the sources use for this. They seem so helpful for taking the blame away. Can you walk us through the wise owl and guard dog idea?
Sure. So the rational thinking part of the brain, the bit that knows they should be in school, that wants to learn, is described as the wise owl. Then there's the emotional reactive brain, the limbic system, driving the fear and anxiety that's likened to a guard dog. The therapist explains that this guard dog is only trying to protect them, but it's become, well, overworked and maybe a bit overzealous.
Okay.
So the mission becomes calming that overworked guard dog, teaching the wise owl how to manage the stress response. They also talk about the stress bucket, this idea that stress builds up and needs emptying regularly.
That's clever. Because it completely reframes it, doesn't it? It takes the blame off the child entirely. It puts it onto this tiny automatic part of the brain that's just trying too hard. And crucially, it suggests that together they can learn to manage it.
Exactly. And that immediately gives the child and the parents a kind of neutral language. They can talk about the guard dog being hyper alert without it feeling like blame or criticism.
Right. Makes sense.
So once that foundation's laid, the following sessions use very specific, very forward-focused questions. They use exception questions, asking things like, tell me about a time, even a tiny moment, when it didn't happen. Or, when did you feel even a little bit less anxious about school?
Mm.
And they're always looking for and celebrating tiny successes. Even if the child just managed to stay 10 minutes longer than the day before, that's a win.
And then there are strengths questions, too.
Yes. Asking things like, what superpower or strength did you use to manage that 10 minutes? Reframing any past attendance, however brief, as evidence of their own existing resilience.
So it's constantly shifting focus towards progress, however small.
Precisely. Using questions like, what would be just one small sign, something you'd notice, that things are moving in the right direction this week?
And this ties into scaling, right? The 1 to 10 thing.
That's right. The scaling technique. Using a simple 1 to 10 scale to track things like confidence or maybe happiness about the school situation. And there's a neat little tactic sometimes used.
Yeah.
If a child rates themselves really low, say a 3 out of 10, the therapist might express genuine surprise, like, wow, a 3, what stopped you being a 2?
Ah, I see. So it subtly reinforces the strength they already have to be at a 3, not lower.
Exactly. It's a gentle reframe that confirms their existing capacity, their starting point.
Which leads, I suppose, to the famous miracle question.
Indeed. Asking the child to imagine waking up tomorrow and miraculously, the problem is gone. What would be different? what's the first thing you'd notice? Huh. It helps them visualize that preferred future, make it feel more tangible, more real.
Okay, so you visualize the goal. And then what about the hypnotherapy part? The trance.
Right. It's really important to clarify this. We're talking about clinical hypnotherapy here, which is basically guiding the client into a state of deep, focused relaxation. In this state, they become more responsive to positive suggestions and imagery. It's absolutely not the kind of stage hypnosis you see on TV.
So the therapist can't make them do anything they don't want to do.
Absolutely not. The child is always in control. It's about harnessing their own focus.
And how is that focus state used therapeutically?
Primarily for mental rehearsal or reframing. So after the child has described their miracle, feeling calm, walking into school easily, maybe greeting friends, the therapist uses guided imagery, metaphors, maybe specific scripts to help them vividly rehearse that successful scenario in their mind while they're deeply relaxed.
So they're using the mind's own power to make that positive future feel achievable, almost familiar.
That's the idea. Building confidence through imagined success. And another core piece, especially for managing expectations, is how homework is framed. It's never called homework. It's always presented as experiments. Let's try an experiment this week, just to see what happens if you...
Like data gathering.
Exactly. The sources explicitly mention, using the analogy of Thomas Edison and his thousands of attempts to invent the light bulb, the message is, if an experiment doesn't work as hoped, it's not failure. It's just useful information for the next experiment. It removes that fear of getting it wrong.
So it's like telling the child, be an Edison, it's all just research.
Pretty much. It reframes potential setbacks as learning opportunities.
And these experiments, the goals set, they have to be really small, right? Achievable.
Absolutely crucial. We're talking tiny, non-threatening steps. An experiment might simply be getting fully dressed for school without feeling distressed.
Or maybe just standing at the school gate for 5 minutes, even if they don't go in.
Yes. Or perhaps attending one specific club or class they usually enjoy, something outside the main pressure points. Small steps build momentum.
Okay, it feels like a very practical step-by-step approach.
It is, and it all ties back to that underlying therapeutic structure of SFH. If you boil it down, there are sort of six core goals. One, teach the child and offer the family about the brain's stress response. Two, normalize the child's behavior, remove the blame. Three, help them relax deeply and visualize positive experiences, rehearse success. Four, help them actively recognize their own strengths and past successes, however small. Five, collaboratively set those small, achievable goals of the experiments. And six, arguably the most important, equip the child with lifelong coping skills. Build resilience that lasts way beyond just getting back into school.
That's a really comprehensive summary, it feels like. Well, like therapeutic architecture built entirely on hope and capability, doesn't it? We started this deep dive looking at that stark 7.2% absence rate. We defined EBSA really clearly as a can't issue rooted in overwhelming negative feelings, not a want issue. We unpacked that complex web of causes, everything from sensory overload and neurodivergence through to family dynamics. And then we examined this very forward-looking SFH methodology.
And the power of it, I think, really lies in that fundamental shift in mindset. By taking away the blame, focusing relentlessly on existing strengths and that desired future, the child shifts from feeling guilty, maybe helpless, to feeling empowered. Empowered to conduct experiments, to learn that their brain, their guard dog, is actually trying to help, even if it's a bit overenthusiastic sometimes.
Right. So, thinking about this for you, listening now, what's the takeaway? Well, if the core idea of SFH is essentially teaching a child that their anxiety is just this well-meaning guard dog needing a bit of management, and that they already have the resources, the strengths to manage it, what does that suggest about the power we all might have? The power to reframe our own internal narratives around anxiety or feeling overwhelmed? If we acknowledge that maybe our own anxiety is just a misguided attempt at protection, perhaps our own wise owl can take the lead a bit more often, a bit more quickly. That's the knowledge you now carry forward.